WWE audio. Don't know about that. I don't have that. That thousands of pages of exact transcript of what went on. That to me, that's more important. The audio you're going to miss. Sometimes it's hard to copy what they said. I thank you, Paul. Rich, you want to make a comment? Go ahead. N2EO, KQRIW.
A couple of things. Two things. First of all, K1FO, I think his name was Steve, he passed away. We did run a company called LunaLink, and his antennas are considered some of the best as far as gain and pattern. I think you'll agree with me. Also, why did the government kill off, I think it was called Project Moonray, where they were supposed to put a 2-meter repeater on the moon? I think the package was built, but never allowed to go up.
Yeah, that was headed up by Mr. Nick Marshall, who was heavily involved in the early Oscar projects in California. He came to the East Coast, stationed himself at Nassau Community College, W6OLO. Nick Marshall was in the process of doing Project Moonray, in which he and his band of guys were in the process of building a repeater that was going to be on 432 megacycles and was going to be placed on the moon. They thought they had permission to build a piece of hardware and send it there by way of the Apollo program. They thought they had that permission. They did not complete a piece of hardware. So if you think that they built a piece of hardware and sent it to NASA and had gone through qualification testing and was ready to go and was canceled, absolutely not. I was there. I went to a number of their meetings, and they had lots of good ideas as to how they're going to build that piece of hardware. They never quite put it all together in time. They were, from my point of view, about a year and a half late of completing a piece of hardware, which they didn't build, and giving it to NASA early enough in order to be space qualified. You don't put any piece of junk on something like an Apollo mission, because if it had, by modern day standards, if it had a lithium battery that suddenly exploded, boy, that could create an awful lot of grief. You didn't have lithium batteries in those days, but you still had to have space qualified hardware. So they had a good goal, didn't quite pull it off soon enough, Rich. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I'd like to thank Paul for that information. That's going to make him very happy, because that's exactly what he's looking for. He could probably spend a month there. That was very good. Let me let it drop. I'll go on to the last question. KC2WGB. Well, we've talked a lot about antennas, and this is a gentleman who has a question. Would like to know what you think the ideal 80-meter dipole antenna, how it would be built, height, consist of. He has an 80-meter antenna now. He's experienced a lot of noise. Get up at 35 feet and get it approximately another 10 feet. Not sure if it will solve the problem he has. He has this noise that is not man-made. He doesn't think it's man-made, but it's constant, and it's really irritating for him. So give him a description of a good 80-meter antenna. Let's see if that fits for him, and maybe any improvements or anything he can noise at 80 meters. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, most of the antennas that we build on a frequency like 80 meters are horizontally polarized. In the case of man-made noise, a majority of man-made noise, is it horizontal or vertical? Good question. Depending on where you live and the time of day and so on. I'm not sure which is more noisy. There are people who have put up a vertical antenna, vertically polarized antenna, and they thought they saw a considerable improvement. The people who build loop antennas think they get a hell of a lot less noise. But a so-called ideal 80-meter dipole, well, I guess it would be 135 feet long, 14-gauge piece of wire, something like 120 feet in the air, strung between two trees, and there's one north-south and one east-west, and maybe there's one vertical nearby. As you start lowering the dipole closer to the ground, out to the horizon. Let me drop it. The amount of signal that gets out to the horizon starts coming down by a predictable amount. There are various places you can go to, like the ARRL antenna book, in which they will show you curves of what the vertical antenna pattern looks like for your dipole-like antenna at various altitudes above the ground. The reflection off the ground is what changes that pattern, and as you get lower and lower to the ground, more of the signal is squirted straight up because of ground reflection, and less of it goes out to the horizon because of a kind of cancellation effect. The signal reflecting off the ground going to the horizon gets 180 degrees of phase shift on ground bounce, as opposed to the signal going straight out to the horizon. So for a horizontally polarized signal, you tend to get almost a null on the horizon at low altitudes. Vertically polarized antenna doesn't do that. Gives you a strong signal out to the horizon. But now a vertically polarized signal at a high altitude that clears your local terrain and trees and buildings and water towers, that represents a little bit of a problem unless you've got a pretty tall tree or some other strong local structure you can put that vertical antenna on. Some people have strung a vertical antenna by hanging it out the window of a multi-story apartment building, for instance. Let me drop it. As long as you resonate it, it can work very well. And the nice thing about a vertical antenna is that you have to forget about feeding it in the center. There's nothing magic about feeding it in the center. You take a vertical antenna and you feed it from the outer edge. Yes, you're feeding a 1500 ohm impedance. Yes, you need an impedance matching device, a simple LCL network, which you can easily design by going to the Berkeley website. You Google the word impedance matching plus Berkeley, you'll come up with a computer program that when you give it the data of what frequency and what impedance is your antenna, it will tell you how to design a very simple network. It gives you a whole bunch of solutions, and you choose the one that you like, and it does all that in roughly 1 second, and you give it the data. Very handy program, because impedance matching of an antenna that's not a 50-ohm device, 50-ohm resistor, impedance matching is very important. It's part of what we all call resonating, so to speak. So there are an amazing number of people who strung a simple piece of green wire, is what Mel used to do, K2KEY. Ain't that terrible? I mean, he and I were together for a decade. K2KEY, Mel Schneider in Brooklyn, took a piece of green wire, strung it in the evergreen tree out in front of his house, vertically polarized, and fed the bottom end of it, and had an extremely high performance on 80 meters. Talked to guys who thought that he was running multiple kilowatts, if you know what I mean. And in his environment in Brooklyn, that gave him less noise and more performance. So antenna experimenting is something we all do as ham radio operators. No matter how much wiring you've got up in the air, add some more wire. Vertically, horizontally, east, west, north, south. There is no ideal dipole on 80 meters. As long as you've managed to get a reasonably good impedance match with your antenna tuner, open wire line, coax cable, whichever you like, feeding it in the center or at one end, whichever you like, there's advantages of each, and possibly making it vertically polarized. Lots of experiments are required to find the ideal antenna for you in your environment. And with various kinds of experiments, the extra noise that you're hearing, and everybody on 80 meters hears noise, particularly during the summertime when there's a whole lot of thunderstorms. 80 meters tends to be a bit quieter in the winter, but still you're going to hear, in many cases, quite a bit of noise. And now for you to find out, is the noise that you're getting at your location, is it local man-made noise or is it atmospheric? In the case of atmospheric noise, there's not a great deal you can do about it. By directional antennas, sometimes the noise is louder to the north than to the east, and by steering a directional antenna or designing a directional antenna to null out the direction of greatest noise will give you some improvement. But if it's local man-made noise, by doing fox hunting techniques, you can eventually find out what is the source of noise. If it's your local power line company, there's ways you can get them to correct it. If it's somebody's fish tank heater a block away, there's ways you can zero in on that and help that person make an than an oscilloscope. Let me drop this. If you use a good oscilloscope, maybe synchronized to 60 hertz, and you look at the noise, you'll easily see the signature difference between power line noise and other kinds of noise. But if you find out that the noise that you're experiencing is a spiky kind of noise as opposed to a more steady state, random noise, there are kinds of noise blankers that will help you an awful lot. The noise blanker that's in the Drake R4C receiver was arguably the world's best. Some of the early Kenwood receivers, Kenwood 520, Kenwood 820, they also had an extremely good noise blanker. So if the noise you're experiencing is a spiky kind of noise, then a noise blanker can do a beautiful job of eliminating it, giving you almost no detriment to the high fidelity audio you're trying to listen to. KC2WGB, K2RW in the TechNet.
N2EO with a comment, Dick.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, there's something you mentioned earlier, Dick. You know, when I was able to walk and I lived in Whitestone, I was getting terrible noise, and I traced it down. A neighbor on the corner, it turned out, what you said before, he had a arcing doorbell transformer, and he was very nice. He knew how to repair it to fix it. Had a change transformer. He worked for the telephone company. So he was very gracious and he changed it, and that was that. Back to you, Dick.
That's good information there, Rich. When it comes to an arcing doorbell transformer, an arcing fish tank heater, and things like that, when you look at that noise that you receive on your ham radio receiver, and couple that audio into an oscilloscope, there's a very characteristic signature that arcing 60 cycles noise makes. You'll see that it makes bands of noise, so to speak, at certain periods of time during the 60 cycle waveform. It might be arcing during the positive peak and negative peak, and not doing any arcing during the crossover. That's a very characteristic signature you'll recognize on your oscilloscope, which can help you identify, is it local arcing man-made noise, or is it ionospheric noise? And again, even the spiky kind of noise you get from an arcing doorbell transformer, with the right kind of noise blanker, a lot of that can be alleviated. I didn't say thoroughly canceled, but you can make a huge 5, 10, 15 decibel improvement by way of a noise blanker. And when it comes to the noise blankers in ham radio receivers, some of them have extremely good ones, and some of them have very mediocre ones. And whenever you look at any of the ratings of various rigs, unfortunately, the quality of the noise blanker is not one of the things that they rate. You have to talk to your fellow ham radio operators that happen to have experience using various rigs where they've used the noise blanker, so you can find out which ones really work well. I'm a little disappointed that the ARL doesn't cover that particular subject. It's an important one, in my opinion. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, there were quite a few noise blankers that were very successful. And I know on my Kenwood 2000s, it leaves a lot to be desired. It doesn't work as well as it should. Okay, Dick, that's about it from the mailbag. And let's go over to Paul and see what exciting stuff he has going on. And we'll find out where Voyager is. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to make a guess that Voyager is something like 128 astronomical units away. Something like 12,500 to 12.5 billion miles. Something like 37 hours of round trip time to talk to it, and it's speeding away. And New Horizons, moving really fast. I think New Horizons might have an even greater velocity than Voyager. There, I'm not sure. Paul's going to make that clear for us. WS2N with the space report. K2RW in the TechNet. You've got it, Paul.
6DPZ, can I mention about noise blankers before Paul grabs it?
Yeah, tell us your experience with noise blankers, Hal.
Hold on one sec, Paul. Well, one of the most efficient noise blankers is ones I've worked with that sample 47 megahertz and then punches holes in the noise used by Collins. Really interesting concept. They sample a higher frequency and punches noise into the IF to take out the noise. That's everything I wanted to say, Dick. I've worked on a few of those and also some LAM noise blanking systems.
Dick, weren't they noise inverters?
Well, what do you think, Hal? Was it a noise inverter or a blanker? I'll bet you it was blanker. Over to you, Hal.
Blanker. It received at 47 megs, especially using one of the KWM2s in the mobiles. And if it used car radio antenna to receive the noise pulses, then it punched holes in the IF to take out the noise spikes.
And you got to do that switching of the IF before the IF filtering takes place. Because after it's been through one stage of IF filtering, it sends it into ringing, if you know what I mean. Turns out that Mel, K2KUI, did a fair amount of experimenting with noise inverting techniques. And if it was carefully tuned for his particular kind of local noise, he felt he was getting a significant improvement. But to do noise inverting, you've got, in other words, you not only got to get the timing just right, but you've got to get the amplitude of the inverting just right in order to create cancellation. It's difficult. In the case of the kind of 47 megahertz noise blanker that Hal's talking about, it recognizes the fact that when you get a spiky kind of noise, look at it with a spectrum analyzer. Most spiky kinds of noise goes very wide in frequency region. It tends to, depending on the rise time of the spike, if it was 1 microsecond, for instance, the noise would peak at roughly 1/1 microsecond, a megahertz, and it would be loudest at a megahertz, and from there on fall off 6 dB per octave as you go up in frequency. That's the physics of spiky noise. And so what Collins recognizes is that spiky noise happens to have a significant amount of energy left over at 47 megahertz. 47 megahertz was an empty frequency where nothing was there, so you didn't get ambiguity. So by receiving and rectifying the noise at 47 megs, that became the command signal to open up a switch in front of the IF strip to punch holes in the time domain, as Hal was describing it. And therefore, you stopped the noise before it got a chance to get into your first IF filter, and therefore send your IF strip into ringing. That's somewhat like what was being done with the Drake R4C. There they had a delay line going into the real IF, and they had an upfront detector that looked at the spiky noise, and it opened up...
Repeater, timeout.
And it opened up a very fast-acting field effect transistor switch in front of the IF strip before the IF strip got a chance to do any ringing. And that Drake R4C noise blanker, which was an auxiliary item you added to the receiver, that field effect transistor noise blanker was so effective that when those radar pulses from the Montauk Point radar, when it was operating, there were times when that radar was 100 and more decibels above my threshold, and it would completely take out all of those noise signals, every bit of it. Did a beautiful job. Any further comments on this, Hal? K6DPZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
You hit it, Dick. I'm very familiar with the Drake noise blanker also. It was a good concept of doing it. The phasing idea is good also, but it's very critical because you've got to be exactly 180 degrees out to cancel out the noise. Go ahead, let Paul do his space report.
You've got it, Paul.
Okay, real fine, Hal. And, okay, Dick. Talking about Voyager, I might as well give you that report before we go on. That is out, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, of course. Yeah, Voyager 1 is out to 133 AU from the sun, and Voyager 2 is like 110 AU. So, I mean, since we've been really tracking it intently on the net, that's probably gone up probably about 8 or 9 AU when we started. out there, it'll be going actually about 8,000 miles slower than the Voyages. Voyages are almost 40,000, so New Horizon will be about, you know, 31,000 miles per hour. So pretty fast. The good news for New Horizon is they've got a location for it to go now. 4 years from now, they have a date, January 1st, 2019. Should be visiting Kuiper Belt object. I think it's around 30 miles in diameter or so. But they know where to send it. So they'll be very happy to get some kind of results that far out. Don't forget, Voyager stopped its planetary missions at Neptune, never got to Pluto, and never got to see any other Kuiper Belt objects. So New Horizons is going to do a couple of steps better. And with all the modern-day cameras and all the modern-day detecting equipment on board that thing, it should do pretty well. And everything's working. Voyager, you got a lot of things shut down. The actuators, you can't articulate anymore. The cameras don't work. About the only thing I think working on Voyager is detecting the magnetic field and where the particles are coming from. Cosmic particles. That's pretty much it. Should we go on, Dick? Do you have any more questions about Voyager before we continue the space portion of the net?
Question for Paul Antonio.
Rich recognized where you said that New Horizons is moving 8,000 miles an hour slower and is moving at 31,000 miles an hour. That suggests that Voyager is moving at something like 39,000 miles an hour and 133 astronomical units. Turns out to be something like 12.37 billion miles away. My goodness, is that down the road a piece? It's out there detecting those solar wind particles and the local magnetic field. And thank goodness those detectors are still working, even though after all of these years, let's see, I think that was launched somewhere around 1977. So that's been, close to 30 some odd years in flight, all being powered by the nuclear power supply, because solar panels way out there don't work. I don't think solar panels have been used anything beyond Jupiter. When it comes back to you on that one, Paul, you can confirm that for me. N2EO, K2RAW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. I don't know if this is a directed net, but I'd like to ask Paul. I saw something on Yahoo News. They found a star, a sun, you could call it, with a planet Earth-like size in the Goldilocks zone. It said in their words were that astronomers are freaking out. They're saying it could very well have intelligent life way ahead of ours, because something, I think it said something about, is a satellite going around that planet? Human-like made?
Yeah, there's two stories going out. Two separate stories, Rich. The one about what they think, it's been discounted already, but they thought there's an outside chance maybe there's some kind of huge structure going around the orbit with this planet around the star. Maybe it's some kind of artificial creation that was put out there. They were getting some strange readings, and now they've decided it's probably a bunch of comets that broke up near the sun or something of that nature. But it was fun for them to think about it, just the erratic readings that they were getting. They look at the sun, the light of the star, and the way that it it fades in and out, and it was showing him something different. That's one story. The other story is an Earth-like looking type of or Earth-size planet that they found around 36 light years away from here, which is actually pretty close astronomically wise, and that thing is around 400 degrees temperature. It's kind of close to its star, so it's probably too hot for any kind of life. But you know, the idea that maybe at one time it might have had water, and, the idea that they could detect Earth-sized planets is pretty exciting for the astronomers, especially in the future when we get better measurements, and then they'll start pointing the James Webb Space Telescope, which will be launched in 2018, and they'll be looking at methane or oxygen, whatever kind of chemicals might be in the atmosphere of these planets, with James Webb using the infrared space telescope. So there were like two separate.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Continue on with the report anyway. This is WS2N.
Yeah, I'm going to throw in a couple of words here, Paul, and you're going to correct me. As time goes on, we're finding a larger and larger number of candidate planets going around other stars, and in many cases we're confirming that they really are planets there. Up till now, almost all of our detecting has been indirect. You either look at the wobble of the star caused by the gravity field of the attraction of the planet that's circling that star. So you look for this very gentle amount of star wobble, and you study that waveform, and you say, yeah, I see one, two, three planets. Or you wait for the planet to pass in front of the star. That's the main thing that Kepler telescope was doing, looking for the very slight dimming of the total amount of light coming from the star when the planet passes in front of the star from our point of view, which only catches something like 1% of the planets. But these are both indirect techniques. We're slowly getting the capability. Let me drop it. We're beginning to make direct measurements by way of a real good coronagraph-like function, for instance. A coronagraph is where you put a blockage in front of your telescope, hopefully very far away, just the right diameter and size, with just the right orientation, so you can block out the light of the star, and now you can see the planets going around it. The light of those planets is a couple of million times dimmer than the light from the star. So the light from the star overloads the living daylight out of your telescope, blinds it, so to speak, and you can't see the planets. By way of a very good coronagraph, where you can block out the star, the best coronagraph for our environment is the moon. During the time the moon is just in the right position, it is just the right diameter where it blocks out the sun, now you can see the corona around the sun, you can see other planets and stars, you can see all kinds of things, but notice that particular coronagraph, in the case of the moon, is a quarter of a million miles away, and it's an object 2,000 miles in diameter. Let me drop. One of the experiments being investigated by NASA right now is to make a space-borne coronagraph. When it comes to looking for extrasolar planets directly, if you can put a blocking device 50,000 miles ahead of, it's about a 10 or 15 foot diameter device with just the right kind of edge softening pebbles on it, and you mount it 50,000 miles ahead of your telescope, so it blocks out the light of that particular star, now you stand the chance of seeing the planets, seeing them well enough that not only you can count the planets, look at their diameters, look at how bright they are, and we're starting to also get to the ability of, to some degree, measure the chemistry that's in the atmosphere around the planets. And as you get the ability to measure more planets, and we got thousands of them so far, and you start measuring the chemistry of the atmosphere, and you start seeing things like methane and carbon dioxide, the things that are, in some cases, given off, or oxygen, given off by living plant or animal organisms, now you're getting more and more information. It's an exciting field. It's just a matter of time. It is my belief that a number of people within the sound of a pole and my voice right now, a number of us in a short period of time are going to hear NASA make measurements that gives us some kind of confirmation of living organisms on some other planet or celestial body. It's just a matter of time, because there's lots of evidence by way of the Stanley Miller experiment that you start off with the right raw ingredients. Let me drop it. You start off with the right raw ingredients and wait long enough. There is lots of evidence that life is spontaneous as we know it. If the right raw ingredients and you wait long enough, life will form every time. So we have strong reason to believe there's a lot of life out there. It looks like every single star has planets. And that's a huge change of what was happening in the days of Frank Drake. Frank Drake made the first search for extraterrestrial intelligence measurement at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, Green Bank, West Virginia, 1960. He had this 85-foot dish that had just been constructed. It was built a little bit ahead of schedule, and he was using it to look for living radio signals from a couple of nearby stars. So we've only been searching for extraterrestrial intelligence for 45 years, and yes, we haven't found it yet. It's like saying that I've taken a cup of water out of the Atlantic Ocean, and I haven't confirmed that there's any life here yet. Well, we've got to take a lot more glasses of water out of the ocean, is the way Jill Tarter puts it when you go to her TED Talk. If you go to the TED Talks and you look up Jill Tarter, who is the head of the SETI search in the United States right now, which is being privately funded, she is convinced that it's just a matter of time with better and better techniques that we're going to find life out there. We're not alone, just that we're a little bit rare in this neighborhood. WS2N, K2RIW, Great Wall.
I agree that someday you're going to hear a report that NASA believes there's some kind of life on other worlds, but, you know, they'll see a methane signature or something. Oxygen. So they'll know the planet is in the Goldilocks zone, and they'll believe that. But get the DX signal from one of the planets. They still think we have a very long wait, no matter how many different directions they point the radio telescopes. I just base it on the idea that, you know, sure, we have life on our planet, intelligent life, but chances of finding another planet like that, with all the different species we've had on Earth, probably, you know, a billion different species maybe, you know, that have come and gone. There's only one that, you know, that developed CW, you know, AM and FM and digital modes, and that's us. And whether or not somebody else will do that, I'm sure with all the billions of stars there's somebody out there, but I think we got a long wait, you know, unless the dinosaurs on another planet, you know, are able to transmit DX signals. Hopefully not. Hopefully, you know, intelligent life is within a couple of hundred light years of us, and we'll be able to hear somebody transmitting away one day. But I'm not going to hold my breath there. I just wanted to mention a couple of flights that will be coming up. You have another expedition mission going up next month to the International Space Station, launched by Russia on a Soyuz spacecraft. Another progress mission probably toward the end of December. But the next American flight I'm interested in is, of course, unmanned, but it will be the Cygnus flight up to the International Space Station to bring almost 8,000 pounds of equipment, material, food, oxygen to the space station. And that will put Orbital back in business. They're the ones 2 Octobers ago that had the Antares rocket blow up after it took off from Virginia, from Wallops Island, and wound up with that failure. They're presently rebuilding that rocket with new engines. And that should be ready to go by springtime. But to keep their contract going with NASA, you know, they signed these billion-dollar contracts to send supplies to the space station. They teamed up with United Launch Alliance, which launches one of the rockets that they launch, is the Atlas V, and they signed two contracts with them to do that. This one coming up December 3rd, and then another one early 2016. It'll be the heaviest launch for the Atlas V. They've launched probably 100 flights since they've been in operation, and a lot of heavy payloads, including the Curiosity rover that went to Mars, but this payload's going to be quite heavy. I think the total weight is, you know, like 30,000 pounds or something for the whole Cygnus spacecraft. So they'll have it encapsulated in the fairing. Cygnus is about almost 12 feet in diameter, probably around 11 feet in diameter, and about 24 feet long. And they put it on top of the rocket. It'll launch from Florida. First time the Cygnus will launch from Florida. The other missions were all launched from Virginia. So I'm looking forward to that. Drop it. Only one website came up with a problem with the International Space Station, but it's a reliable website. I just think it's odd that they're the only ones. They do have a problem with one of the circuits. There's eight separate circuits from the solar arrays coming back to the space station, and one of them shorted out. It's going to take the ground crew a while to figure out where it is and what to do with it, but temporarily it's shut down, and they've rerouted some of the power. This kind of thing has happened before. So they have seven other sources. You know, you have eight sets of solar array wings up there. They call them SOARs. Each one is a SOAR. And the other seven will make up the difference for a while. But eventually they'll try to get the other one back online. So that was interesting. Another topic that we had last week was the fuels, how they ignite. And, you know, for instance, the shuttle uses actual, like almost like a blowtorch ignition in their system. But other flights like the Saturn V, and now the Falcon 9 with SpaceX and some of the other ones, they do use the, I was trying to think of the letters, the TEA and the TEB system for igniting the fuel. So, you know, one is like basically an aluminum base, and the other one is a boron base. One's a tri-dial aluminum, and the other one's tri-ethyl boron. And it's interesting when you watch the Falcon 9, especially take off with the modern cameras they have today, you can see the green right before the ignition takes place. And the green is basically the boron that's being ignited. So this is a way to ignite the fuels. They're hypergolic. These fuels ignite immediately. Now, even so, the Falcon 9, the regular rocket fuel is really kerosene and liquid oxygen. Just to ignite it, they use this TEA, TEB system. But it's not on board the rocket. They have external tanks on the ground, and that's how they do it. So they don't bother putting it on the rocket because it would just add weight. And everything in space flight is to eliminate weight. Let me drop it. This is WS2N. One amateur related topic. I mentioned the failure of the launch from Hawaii that they had last week. They tried to get the Super Strike launch vehicle. It's a rail, launched on a rail instead of a launch complex platform. Suspended from a rail, and they pointed in a certain direction. Got fins on it. They were hoping this big rocket would go into orbit. First they've been trying to get this flight off for a couple of years, and they finally did, and it bailed. It went for about a minute and went out of control. So amateur-related, they did have some amateur satellites on board. They weren't really transponders, you know. They weren't repeaters in the sky. They're basically some beacons that were going to be transmitting on 2 meters, 70 centimeters, 13. So just had to mention that. There's a couple other things, Dick, but I want to, you know, continue on unless you need some fill time. Back to that, WS2N.
Soyuz is going to be making a launch fairly soon, Paul, is what you just said. I think Soyuz brings a total of 3 cosmonauts, astronauts, up to the International Space Station. When that next Soyuz launch takes place, what's the total number of human beings that are going to be on the International Space Station? And where that could become a little bit troublesome is the fact that the American quarters of the ISS has one single toilet, the Soviet end has one single toilet, and so and occasionally they get a toilet failure. So things can get a little bit a little bit uncomfortable for the astronauts if you've got let me pick a number, a total of 9 people on board, and one of those toilets should fail. Give us some points on this, Paul. I'm getting down to some pretty basic stuff here. WS2N, K2IW.
I guess if they got desperate, there's 2 other spacecraft attached, the Soyuz, and in this case there'll be 3 docked to the space station. I guess you could always use the Soyuz. We'll take a number. The most they ever had on board was 13. You know, the shuttle used to go up quite a bit before it was retired in 2011. But again, the shuttle had its own vapid facilities, so that was not a problem. But of course, in December they'll be launching another expedition group up, and they'll stay for 6 months. And they leave their spacecraft attached to the space station the whole time. And when they leave, they take that spacecraft with them, same Soyuz that you go up with, usually come back down with, unless you're Scott Kelly and his Russian partner. They're staying up for a whole year, so their spacecraft already left. You know, they outlived their usefulness. So the last group that came up that stayed for 10 days took their spacecraft with them and left theirs behind. So it gets they have to juggle it around on how they do that. And in fact, that's why they like to keep them up there for exactly a whole year, but the time starts to run out on the other spacecraft. He'll just get a little over 11 months on the space station. They could go longer if they had to. It's all part of the deal. You know, they know how long they can stay for, and they figure on contingency plans in case there's problems and they can't get back. That's what happened with the Italian lady, Samantha Christopher Eddy, and her two crewmates were up there, and they got stuck for an extra month or so. It could actually happen where Scott Kelly stays for a whole year, but it does get crowded. Yeah, it'll stay crew of 9 probably for another week or 10 days, and they just went through that recently. And then they leave, and it goes around like that. You know, in other words, they're going to come up, and the other 3 will be going down, and this new 3 will stay for another 6 months. You have the same problem that's going to be on the International Space Station American side once we get the IDIS, the International Docking Adapter, attached to the space station. We're supposed to have one by now, but it blew up on the SpaceX on the way up last summer, and eventually there's supposed to be 2 for almost the same reason. You know, we would like to have 6, let's say 6 people up there for the, you know, on the American side, the capability. You would need 2 spacecraft attached to two docking ports, you couldn't have that. You'd have to have, you know, three people would have to leave. Now you only have three people on board, and then the other three would have to come up. This way you could have, let's say, six people on board, and you do what the Russians are doing now, and then you could have three more come up, and they could dock. You'll have two ports on the American side, and then you'll have the four ports on the back for the Russian side, so you'll have plenty of ports, you know. So it makes it convenient. So they would like to eventually have two docking ports, either connections, that's international docking and that is attached. So we'll see. That'll start next year, and they rebuilt another one. But I think that flight, they're going to have the beam go up. That's the Bigelow expansion module that's going to be attached to the Tranquility node, one of the nodes on the American side. It's going to be attached to the one of those ports, and they're going to inflate it. I think that's the next one after, let's see. Yeah, that would be the next SpaceX flight. That will probably be early, probably January of 2016. They'll bring the beam up, and then after that, they'll have a couple of ITA flights, so they'll be able to dock American spacecraft to the space station. Back to you, Dick. I hope I'm not losing everybody. This is WS2S.
Comment, and wheel.
Yeah, good stuff, Paul. I've got a quick question for you, and that is, when the next Soyuz goes up, there's going to be a total of three Soyuz craft docked with the International Space Station. You also have a Progress ship on the way up. That's the fourth thing that's going to dock. What's the maximum number of things that can be docked right now? Is four that number, Paul? Back to you, Paul.
Yeah, you have four. One, it's at the rear of the space station. That's attached to the Zesda. You know, that's the whole run of the Zesda, the Z-axis, I guess you would call that, of the whole space station. So that's number one. And then you have three other active ports. The PIRS, P-I-R-S, that's one. The Rasta, that's two, another Russian one. And then another one coming out of they call it the Zenith port of the Zarya module. One, two, yeah, that would be four. They have four different places. But the Russians, they have a docking system. It's the same for either the Progress or for the Soyuz, so they could dock anywhere. You know, in fact, if they want to clear a spot in the rear, because the next one coming up is going to have plenty of fuel, they'll think nothing of taking a crew of three. You know, all three will get into the spacecraft, because you can't just take one guy and pull the spacecraft out. He has to go with all three in the spacecraft. In case something happens, then they can all return to Earth. If one guy goes out, the two people are on board and no longer have a seat. So if they're going to just relocate a spacecraft from one port to the other, all three get in, they relocate, and they've done this quite a few times. And then the new Progress craft will come up, dock to the Zesda, which is the back of the International Space Station, and they'll have be a fueling Progress craft, and they'll be able to raise the height of the International Space Station. Yeah, four there, and then you have on the American side. Now they can utilize two cargo locations. The goal is on the American side that we want two cargo locations and we want two spacecraft locations. Spacecraft locations on the American side are different than the cargo. We on the Russians are all the same. You think, well, okay, that's a bad thing. Why don't we have all the same? But we can, when we dock our cargo ones, we have 50-inch diameter things that we could open up. We could bring in large racks of experiments and things where the Russians can't. They, you know, they only have a 31-inch, it's actually about 33 inches diameter, something. That's it. They don't
want to reminisce about space. I was always interested in it as a child. My father would lay down next to me in the bed as I drifted off to sleep, and I would always ask him if man, I don't know how I worded it, was ever been to the moon yet. And then I remember when Sputnik was launched, tiny balls of metal, four sticks coming out like metal, and it wasn't called a satellite, they called they just reported it as an artificial moon. And my mother took me to FAO Sports data balloon with four wooden sticks coming out of it, simulating the artificial moon Sputnik. And by the way, it transmitted above as a ham or shortwave listener, which I wasn't. It transmitted on 20.995 megahertz, just below 15 meters. So you can easily take a ham receiver of it today, go down 5KC and listen to Sputnik. I also remember when Telstar was launched. I believe that was the first television satellite, and it was a fast flyby. It would come in for a few minutes and go out. They were marveling because they had an aerial view of the building with the smoke where the Pope was being elected. So that's what I remember. And of course, in elementary school, you all were brought into the auditorium to watch Alan B. Shepard launched on Redstone, on the first Redstone rocket. Back to Ned and to Leo.
You're right, those were exciting times. That Sputnik, those four spikes coming out of it, really were four monopoles. And depending on how they were fed, I guess you could call it a four-sided turnstile antenna that they were fed 90 degrees out of phase. Each of those four monopoles that were slanted backwards. And 19.995 megahertz. And I think the signal it transmitted was something like HI in Morse code. And the rate at which it transmitted the HI, I think, represented the temperature. Was that roughly the nature of the transmission, as you remember, Rich? Over to you, K2RIW.
I think what I remember is it's going beep, beep, beep. By the way, when Telstar went up, a song came out on the radio. It was on the AM band, of course, by a group known as the Telstars. And then there was another group called the Tornadoes that recorded the same song.
Yeah, Rich, they were called the Benches. The Benches was the name.
Paul, was Telstar launched approximately 1963? Is that roughly the year?
58 to 59, Paul.
The exact year. It was before 1963. I'm going back to what Rich was saying. There was another satellite that transmitted the first TV pictures. Didn't last that long. Right before Telstar, I'm trying to think of the name of it. And it was supposed to transmit some kind of message over to Japan. Meanwhile, Kennedy was killed, so that was 1963. Yeah, maybe I think it was 63. I think you're right.
I think it was 58 or 59.
We'll eventually pin that one down. But the first real international television broadcast live with Yves Montand in France. And then the very next night, 24 hours later, you had a British transmission. And that went to a non-synchronous satellite where the ground station was in Maine in the United States, and the British ground station was the Goonhilly Downs, I think is the name of the location. And I guess France must have also had their own ground station. but it was about a 1/2 hour show, giving you a cross section of life in Paris, as I remember, during that first live television broadcast. I wonder if you've seen any pictures of that. There's YouTube videos that will show you that exact show. WS2N, K2RIW.
No, I haven't seen that. No, I'm still going back to the beginning. I know Richard's talking about October 4, 1957, and that would be Sputnik. And I believe it was, I remember, you know, I'm pretty sure that was it. And it definitely was 15 meters. But, and the diameter was like size, now, bigger than a basketball. It was like almost 2 feet in diameter. And it weighed, I think it was around 250 pounds, a little less than that. And it was a big achievement for them. It was kind of elliptical. You know, they didn't have that circular capability. You know, they didn't have another rocket to go off to circularize it. And people claim that they saw it, but a lot of people think that what they really saw was the upper stage of the Soyuz rocket. Because the upper stage actually wound up going in orbit with it. They think the ball would have been too small to see. There's a lot of stories going on with that. Just wanted to talk about one other topic. I know we talked about solar sails. Dick, let me get this in before I forget. The solar sail situation recently we discussed, but that is another thing coming out. NASA's, I think, funding it. There's a group working on it, and they call it an e-sail. What an e-sail is, they think it'll go faster than a solar rocket. Solar sail would work on the photons hitting the shiny surface. But this is different. This
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Anywhere from a 1/2 mile all the way to 12 miles, I think that's a big one. All the way up to 12 miles, you have all the, dozens of these wires sticking out. And then you put a positive charge on it, and leave this positive charge on it, on these wires. And as the positive protons come near the spacecraft, they're going to repel each other. And it's going to push this thing off, not to the speed of light, but they think eventually twice the speed and longer than, a light sail. Light sail will start to lose its kick over, AU out, where this won't. And they think they could make 20 or 30 AU in 10 years. Was it 10 years or less? I forgot. Yeah, I think it was around 10 years they'd be able to get out to 30 AU. So, we'll see, Dick. I don't know if you heard about that one, but putting a positive charge on wires, it sounds pretty far-fetched to me. It's called the Hertz Group, H-E-R-T-S. I can tell you what it stands for.